Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. As we go behind the headlines today, Missouri lost one of its best-known and most admired jurists this past week with the passing of 69-year-old State Supreme Court Justice Richard Teitelman. He was perhaps less well-known by the man and woman on the street than those in the legal community, but his influence on the court was significant and had an impact on all of us. We'll learn more about Judge Teitelman and that influence with two men who knew him well, personally and professionally. Mike Wolff, the outgoing dean of St. Louis University School of Law, served with him on the state Supreme Court. Attorney and SIU Carbondale journalism professor Bill Freivogel was also a friend. They joined me in studio, along with St. Louis Public Radio reporter Rachel Lipman. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you here today.
Nice to be
pleasure to be here.
Not a particularly pleasant subject to talk about, but I know that all of you look at Judge Teitelman pretty much the same way as the kind of personality he was, the kind of impact he had, a good friend. And let me start with you, Mike. You called Judge Teitelman one of the most remarkable men that you have ever known. How so?
Well, he's a guy who was always cheerful. He overcame extraordinary circumstances. If you think about it, I mean, he when his blindness developed as a child, the parents were counseled to put him in a home for the blind, and his mother insisted that he get an education. And when it turns out that he couldn't do well enough with the mechanics of things to study medicine, he followed his father's footsteps and became a lawyer. Came to St. Louis to go to law school at Washington University, and then he didn't pass the bar because he had to fight to get a reader to help him. And he's a brilliant guy. He spent a couple of years operating out of his home, which was a small one-bedroom apartment where he hung out his shingle, and he represented the United Farm Workers, and that brought him to the attention of David Lander, who was the director of legal services at the time. And they hired him, and 5 years later, he was the executive director of legal services. He went everywhere, talked to everyone, sent people copious notes of congratulations, phone calls. He would leave people voicemail messages at 3 o'clock in the morning. Everything he did was to further the cause of access to justice for the poor. It was extraordinary. The appointment under the nonpartisan court plan, first to the Court of Appeals in 1998, was extraordinary because he's not the kind of guy that you would see coming up for the judiciary. He's not a prosecutor. He's not, you know, kind of standard issue lawyer. He's a legal aid lawyer, and he was our court's first legally blind member and our first Jewish judge. And then in 2002, Governor Holden appointed him to the Missouri Supreme Court. He was a wonderful colleague. Whether you agreed with him on things or disagreed with him, you could hardly not like him. He was just this rotund, friendly presence. I mentioned in a piece I wrote the other day about how he worked the room before the oral arguments of the Supreme Court. And what he really wanted to do, he wanted to see who was there, because he could see from a very close distance. He could read by holding it real close to his face. But he really wanted to touch people and feel them and see who was there. And he had this remarkable ability when he was out there. He would figure out if somebody's parent or child, some lawyer's parent or child, was in the audience. And when the argument was done, he would go into an effusive praise about what a wonderful job the lawyer had done. I mean, it was just an extraordinary human being.
I think the word that we would use would be mensch. I think that got mentioned a couple of times yesterday
yes.
at the memorial service.
And I said in my piece in the Post that he also was a very strategic guy, and he was very good at figuring out how to get things done. I said it wasn't just the power of mensch alone that gets you a Supreme Court appointment, but he was a mensch.
The image of him going down into the gallery, if you will, in the courtroom was really quite a striking one.
It is.
Yeah. Bill, what is your recollection? How did you come to know him?
Well, I really came to know him when he was executive director of the Legal Services Corporation, Legal Services here. I was in Washington writing about President Reagan's attempt to kill the Legal Services Corporation. So Rick was a terrific source of, you know, about stories that I might write. And, you know, as Mike said, he would write you, you know, you would get these typewritten notes if he thought your story was good. I probably have more notes from him than I do anyone else. You know, he's almost like, he's a, really a unique person, almost out of a different century in some ways. I mean, people don't really write little notes like that anymore. They probably should. I exchanged some emails with one of his clerks from a few years ago, from about 10 years ago, David Camp, who's a lawyer. David told some, sent me some pretty interesting little vignettes. He was saying one day he saw Rick outside of the Creve Coeur theater. Just outside, he said, you know, Rick, we want to go see a movie. And Rick said, I don't think I can go back in there right now. They kicked me out. I fell asleep in the movie theater. I think they think that I'm a vagrant. And he said, let's go have something to eat. So they went off and they ate. And after they were done eating, Rick said, we can go back to the movie theater now. I think the shift just changed. another day. So, you know, he really depended upon a set of clerks and assistants to help him out quite a bit. Kathy Blanton was his assistant, who was very, very helpful. Eric Peterson was his most recent clerk. David Camp was telling me about how about 10 years ago he was driving Rick up to a week of oral arguments at the court. But they were leaving about 5 a.m. They had to stop by a little grocery store in North St. Louis that opened up early just for him to get there to get a sardine container, a styrofoam container of sardines. And so Dave, who was driving him in his own car, kept watching that, you know, seeing that thing over there about ready to fall on the floor. Gets up to the court. Judge Titleman says this is his really special stash. You know, this is the greatest stuff. Well, the week passes, and they're coming back on Thursday. And that styrofoam thing of sardines is still there. And they're driving back, and Rick's saying, drive faster. He's always saying, drive faster. And Dave said, well, how do you know I'm not driving fast? And he said, I hear the other cars passing us. So Dave speeds up, and, you know, truck pulls off in front of him. He hits the brakes, and the sardines go all over the floor because Rick has started to eat them. And so by Monday morning, David had bought a new car, which Rick approved of greatly because it had a better, more comfortable seat.
The sardines had been in the car the entire time?
They had been in the court, unrefrigerated.
What time of year was this? Hopefully not August. You know, you mentioned the staff, and Rachel has a nice story to tell, I think. You covered the funeral yesterday.
I did, the memorial service yesterday, and got a call from the Communication Council for the Supreme Court, who I know pretty well, and she said, are you guys going to be providing any kind of streaming? And I said, you know, probably not. I'm sure there's a way we could do it, but we would have had to know. And she said, well, can we get the audio later? And I said, yeah, probably. Why? The court staff. So obviously the court was still functioning, even though many of the upper level officials had gone to St. Louis for the funeral. There were still people down in Jefferson City. And she was saying to me, the staff wanted to hear the funeral, not, you know, just lawyers who had practiced in front of him or upper level people, but the entire sort of bureaucracy that makes the court run wanted to hear it. And that, to me, said, you know, this is not a person who was just doing it for the power, doing it for that everybody wanted to hear how he was being remembered, says, I think, a lot about him.
I can tell you that when he came to Jefferson City, he came mostly for court business because he did a lot of his work here in the Civil Courts Building, and that's where Eric is, and Kathy's in Jeff City, and a retired police officer, Ray Lauer, has been driving him in recent years, so he's got somebody who's a professional driver. But when he goes into the court building, he talks to everybody. Mm-hmm. They all know him. I mean, the clerks, the secretarial staff, the marshals, everybody. He goes around, and he he works the room. He works the place.
The room. Yeah.
And of course they wanted to hear what people were saying about him.
I have a little follow-up on working the room. Sometimes he even took this working the room a little bit too far. Roger Goldman sent me a note saying that he was walking along the St. Louis U campus and he saw Rick over there by the Billiken Buddha. And he went over and said, "Rick, what are you doing? You're talking to the statue." And Rick just laughed and said, "Well, how are you doing?"
Got no response from the statue.
I don't know that.
You don't know that. This was in the era of Biondi. Anything was possible.
Testimony to his popularity once again. Going back to the funeral yesterday, it was a packed house, standing room only, and there were a number of people who made comments during the course of the event. And one of the things that caught my attention, one of the pieces that you brought up, Rachel, was the fact that he was not one of those guys known by just a single name.
Right. By just as Judge Rick, I believe, and Maurice Graham, who is a very good friend of the judges, kind of had a little riff on that yesterday.
Throughout history, we've had those rare individuals who've stood out for being referred to by a single name. Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Napoleon, Gandhi, Bono, Sting. Go to any corner of this state or any community in which more than a few people are gathered. And if you say you saw Rick recently or you had dinner with Rick, people would know exactly who you were talking about.
And I believe it was Maurice Graham, it may have been another one of the speakers yesterday, said that he was comfortable with all of the titles, Your Honor, Judge Titleman, Judge Rick, Just Rick, that he wore all of those roles and embodied all of those roles essentially at the same time.
Mike, how do you think that the judge would have reacted to that particular series of names, including Bono? He probably would have corrected.
He would have corrected the pronunciation, right, because, exactly. You know, one of the things I mentioned to people since my friend passed is that I'm now going to have to start reading movie reviews, because sometimes by the time he got to tell me what a great movie something was, it was already gone on. But my friend Harmon Mosley, who runs the Chase Theaters,
right,
sent me an email that he'd sent to his staff that they're going to put a banner up in the Chase Theaters for Rick for the rest of the holiday season because he was their best customer. And I assured Harmon that he'd have to keep working now that Rick's no longer coming to his theater.
Well, he's also got the moolah theory
yeah,
doesn't he? So
yes,
he better
he
put a banner up there, too.
Yes, because Rick was always in the first row. I mean, you couldn't go to a movie with him or your neck would be real sore, but he sat right in the first row.
We've got to take a break. Let's do that now and come back. We'll talk about Judge Rick Titleman. As most people know by now, that he passed away earlier this week, and we're talking about him with people who knew him and of people who have covered him. And those people would be Mike Wolff, who is the outgoing dean of St. Louis University School of Law, journalist, professor, and lawyer Bill Freivogel, also with us, as is St. Louis radio reporter Rachel Lippman. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue to pay tribute to former Supreme Court Justice Rick Titleman, who died earlier this week. With me in studio, Rachel Lippman of St. Louis Public Radio News, also Mike Wolff, outgoing dean at St. Louis University School of Law, and Bill Freivogel, who is an attorney and a journalist. And, you know, during the break, it's interesting to listen to you guys talk, because there is a real lightheartedness about all of this. Most of the time when people have passed away, you know, everybody's walking around and trying very, very hard to be somber and pay that proper kind of tribute. But this wasn't that kind of a guy. Yesterday, apparently, most of the people who remembered him were remembering the lighthearted aspect of all of this. You were about to tell a story, Mike, during the break. Can you tell it on the air?
Well, yes, it's fine. One of Governor Carnahan's assistants called me right before they were appointing him to the Court of Appeals in 1998, I think it was, and said, Did you know that Rick Titleman is a member of the Federalist Society? You know, that's a conservative lawyers organization. I said, and I laughed at him. I said, of course, he's a member of everything. Yeah. And you were mentioning, Rachel, that they mentioned that he was the immediate past
parliamentarian of the Italian Bar Association. His colleague, George Draper, another Supreme Court judge, made the comment of, we weren't always sure what race he was. He was with the Asian Bar. He joined the Mountain City Bar. He joined Women's Bar.
Mm-hmm.
And
women's
you mentioned to me, Mike, when we talked earlier this week, that you know, he would then use those connections to further legal services.
Absolutely.
To make it cool to support aid for the poor.
That was his agenda. He really wanted everybody to be on board. And I mentioned to you and others that the lawyer prom, mm-hmm. the Justice for All Ball, that was his creation. And every year there's several hundred lawyers and their partners, spouses, and whatever, about 1,000 people show up, dressed all up, to support legal services. Mm. That doesn't happen anyplace else. I mean, he made it cool.
Yeah, it was a personal cause, but it's not an advancement of a personal agenda. It's not about Judge Titleman. It's we want to do this because legal services.
Not everybody obviously is like that. Bill, you wanted to.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, equal justice, that's what he really, really cared about. I rely here again on David Camp, one of his clerks, for this story. He said that when he was remembering a time, and he said this actually happened a number of times, when they would they'd be having trouble finding the precedent that they were looking for to maybe back up an argument, and Rick would say to them, you'll start thinking about this in a broader way, you know, broad constitutional protections like, say, fundamental fairness. And then he would tell the story of a case that he knew about, or maybe it was a case he had handled once, of a man who had been arrested for shoplifting a can of dog food. And so, you know, the prosecutor was about to prosecute him, and it turned out, you know, the man was caught red-handed. He had a can opener in his pocket. Well, it turned out that his family had run out of food stamps, and he was shoplifting a dented can of food, thinking that the store couldn't sell it anyway, and he was going to try to eat it on the way home before he got home to his family, just to sort of like preserve his dignity. Mm. Well, once the prosecutor knew about all the facts of the case, the prosecutor said, "Oh, we're not going to prosecute this." And so, you know, Rick would say, "So." You got to think about the whole context and think about these things in a much more, in a much broader, in a broader way. He sort of did that himself. And one of the cases that he wrote a dissent in, you know, was that one. It was the Glossop case involving, you know, whether the surviving partner of a trooper,
who was killed,
could get survivor's benefits, and the court ruled that he could not because they weren't married, and
legally couldn't be in Missouri.
And then
there's a gay couple,
right? Yeah. And Rick, you know, pointed out that this was just a legalism. And that it was against fundamental fairness, and went through sort of the whole history of discrimination, you know, against African Americans, laws against interracial marriage, laws against same-sex, the whole history of discrimination, and said, you know, it's just time for this to end.
Mm-hmm. That's an opinion that Tony Rothart, who argued that case, he's with the ACLU in Missouri, argued that case in front of Judge Titleman and the rest of the panel. He cited that as being, you know, an opinion that was just ahead of its time, that, you know, 3 years after that, U.S. Supreme Court says those relationships are recognized. And here he is in, I think, October of 13, arguing, you know, who cares who is married? Yeah. It's still based on the same idea that they love each other.
And that this man gave his life.
Killed on duty
on the highway patrol.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I had mentioned in the introduction that the average man and woman on the street probably wouldn't know Rick Titleman.
That's correct.
That's the way things work in this world.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. But what I'm getting at is there something you can point to, some impact he had on the law that affected all of us, and yet we don't know it was he who caused it to happen?
He wrote an opinion, for example, a few years ago, where he struck down the limitation of damages that are awarded by juries. in injury cases, on the simple grounds that the jury has already decided that the injury was worth this much, and it was unconstitutional, a deprivation of the jury, the right to a jury trial, for somebody to come along and say, no, that arbitrarily we've got to set it at a lower point than that. That affects a lot of people in a lot of cases. And some of the individual cases really showed a sense of justice. He wrote the court's 4-3 opinion in the Joe Amrine case. Joe Amrine was 17 years on a death sentence. And the witnesses against him had recanted. He was in prison when the crime was committed. There was always a corrections officer who said that Amrine didn't do it. And the people who had testified against him were prisoners who got deals for doing that, and they all recanted. And a majority of our court said, well, okay, let's give him a new trial. And of course, they didn't have anything. And I met Mr. Amrine with Rick at a program in Kansas City some time later, and it was very profound. The guy was a very articulate spokesman about the death penalty and the effects of the death penalty. And they were there to recruit lawyers from private practice to do post-conviction work in death penalty cases. So that kind of thing, he had a real systemic effect on post-conviction. And these are cases oftentimes involving what we would consider the worst of the worst. And he had a real feeling for justice, even in those settings.
Wasn't he also involved in the eventual juvenile death penalty that became precedent at the U.S. Supreme Court level? The death penalty for juveniles is cruel and unusual, violates the Eighth Amendment.
As were you.
Yeah, but he did not write he did not write the opinion. I wrote a concurring opinion, but there were four of us who said that violated the contemporary standards, evolving standards of decency. That's what the test for the U.S. Supreme Court uses for cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution. So we set aside young Christopher Simmons' death sentence on that basis. The Supreme Court of the United States upheld it by the same one vote margin in a 5-4 decision.
As the court has in so many decisions in recent memory.
I remember thinking at the time, and I may even have said it to you, that, I mean, this was that maybe Wolf and Teitelman and company had gotten out ahead of themselves, because it's not very common for a state Supreme Court to, to issue a constitutional ruling before the U.S. Supreme Court has done that. But they turned out to be right.
Well, you know, the interesting thing was that the United States Supreme Court had, in two cases from Texas, they had granted review in two cases, which only takes 4 votes, but it takes 5 votes to stay the execution. Mm. And they couldn't get the 5th vote. And 2 of those young men died, were executed. And so the case that was from Missouri was the state was appealing because we had basically gone where the 4 justices had gone, where they were dissenting from the courts not taking the case.
I'd like to return to the memorial service yesterday, because we've already indicated a number of dignitaries were there, including Governor Nixon, who had much to say. And
yes,
Rachel, bring us up to speed on one of the things that the governor spoke about.
So, not to be disrespectful at all to the fact that the judge just died this week, but there's a lot of conversation about there's now a seat open on the Missouri Supreme Court, and the Judge Teitelman had just been retained. I always forget that word, retained, in the 16, which means he would have kept on for another 12-year term.
Except for that age 70.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it would have been a year and right. then would have had a position to fill. So the question has emerged, who should have the right to appoint the judges? And it looks like right now it's probably going to be left up to the next governor, who has indicated that he wants to perhaps change how judges are selected from the current governor picks from a panel nominated by a commission. And yesterday, Governor Jay Nixon gave a fairly full-throated defense of Missouri's current judge selection process.
It's worth noting that without Missouri's strong, independent, nonpartisan court plan, it is interesting to imagine just how far a humble, unprepossessing, blind Jewish legal aid attorney, no matter how brilliant, would get in today's highly polarized political climate.
Well, Mike, what do you think?
In some states, Supreme Court judges run for office as Democrats, Republicans, and otherwise. Mm-hmm. In some states, there's a few states where they're appointed the way federal judges are appointed, where the governor appoints in a Senate confirmation or whatever. Ours is really kind of a hybrid of that because there's a commission that vets the qualifications and the character and fitness of the candidates, gives three candidates from to the governor, and the governor has to appoint one. But then after that, a year after the person's been sitting on the court, they go up for retention, and the voters have a chance to say no. Mm-hmm. And I think that it speaks well for this, for the vetting that's done on the front end, that we've had very little in terms of somebody not being retained at the back end by the voters. And so I think some politicians who want to politicize the judicial system want to make it more politically, quote, accountable. But what it really does is that it takes away, it makes them politicians. And so you have people who are campaigning with campaign promises to rule a certain way in certain kinds of cases. You don't want to have your case come before a judge who's already promised to rule a certain way. And that's the problem with politicizing the judiciary. And I think the Missouri plan avoids that to a great
degree. It's a national model, is it not?
It is. It has been adopted in some form in about 30-some states.
But you know, there was an attempt in 2004, 2 years after he went on the court, to keep him from being retained. There was Phil Schlafly and Rod Jetton and some other rather conservative folks said he's too liberal for Missouri. And he was retained by a healthy margin against what was really a smear campaign. If this had been Illinois, which has judicial elections, I don't know that he would have survived that.
Right. You know, the other thing is that when after that happened, and the Speaker of the House, Rod Jetton, was one of the instigators of it, there was a dinner that our colleague Ray Price had at his home where Jetton was there and Rick was there. This was right after the election, and it was truly extraordinary. They've really got to know each other. And later on, Jetton invited Rick to come and testify on a bill involving blind people.
Interesting.
That doesn't happen.
Strange things happen when you get to know someone, particularly someone that you were considered suspect at some point.
And that was what Rick was about, getting to know people.
Yeah. Should Governor Nixon replace him before he leaves office?
I have a short answer to that, and it bothers some of my friends. No.
Because
I think the system, the way it works, it's never non-political. Let's be clear about that, because whenever you're choosing somebody rather than somebody else, that can be political. But it should be nonpartisan. And there's a period of time where you open the nominations, and then the commission has to interview them and do all that process. Governor Nixon, what did he say? How many days did he have left as governor? 39?
39, as of yesterday. So it would be 38.
It would be truly extraordinary speed to try to fill that before Greitens comes in. And I think Governor Greitens should be given the respect as governor and be given a panel of very well-qualified people and people that he would be interested in appointing. I think that the plan works because we don't make it political, but we also look to see who is the governor and what kinds of people would you don't want the governor communicating with the commission about which individuals he wants, but you do want them to have some cognizance of who the governor is.
Is it Judge Breckinridge who would activate the process, essentially?
Yes.
The mechanism? Okay.
Chief Justice Breckinridge.
Right.
We're going to have to end it there, lady and gentlemen. It's been an interesting discussion, fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for being with us, Bill Freivogel. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mike Wolff, thank you. You're happy to be leaving your job in just a few days as well.
You know, I've really enjoyed the job, and I've got a great successor, and I'm very, very hopeful for the future. And now it's time for me to go. wander off and do something clunk retirement again. I've already done it once. I'm really good at it.
We'll be our next legal roundtable. I'm sure we'll be talking about your successor. Thank you for being with us, Mike. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.